Oh, hi, Mike. Nice to meet you. Oh, nice to meet you. Great.
I made him do fist bumps because of germs.
Oh, okay. Jenny.
Ready. Yep,
you're ready, Jenny. Good afternoon. I will call the March 10th meeting of the Senate Rules Committee to order. And members, thank you for being on time. We have two informational topics to take up today. No bills for today. So we'll just take them in the order that they are on our agenda. And the first is a report from the Secretary of State on the cross-nomination system. Erin, did you have anything to introduce this with? I see we have a copy of the bill.
Yes, I just wanted to say this is a report that was specified in Senate Bill 326, which was passed last session. We did amend the reporting date to March of 2011 in session 2010 in Senate Bill 998, and I believe Steve Trout is here to give an oral report to you.
Great. Steve, if you'd like to come forward and tell us how this is all working out.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Trout, State Election Director, and here today to report on, as Ms. Ziegler said, 2009 Senate Bill 326, which is now codified in ORS 254.135 regarding cross-nominations with respect to the primary ballots. So I just want to give you a report today on kind of the process that we went through and some of the implementation issues that popped up, which led us to take certain actions, and then conclude with some feedback that we've received from the clerks and from our office as far as different calls and questions that were raised. So there, I guess the easiest way to say it is there were some challenges to implement the statute as it was passed. We were not able to implement in a way because there was not enough space on the ballots to be able to print the full party names of three, and in the case of a nonpartisan candidate, the required four party names on the ballot, just because of character limitations that are inherent in the different voting systems that are used throughout the states. As well as that, there weren't any provisions in the bill that applied to the voter's pamphlet, so there wasn't anything that said to include these party names in the voter's pamphlet, and so that was another issue that we had to address, recognizing at all times that our intent was to try and make sure that voters had it as clear as possible, looking out for the voters to make sure that they had as clear of an understanding as they could of what was going on. So after looking at different options and the different implementation challenges that we had throughout the state and with the different voting systems, there's three different voting systems in the state currently, each one of them had their own unique issues with this process with respect to space limitations on the ballot. We came up with the best possible solution that we could come up with, which was abbreviating the party names to a three-letter abbreviation that enabled us to be able to include all of the parties which had been cross-nominated onto the ballots within those character limit restraints that we had on all of the voting systems.
And Steve, could you briefly just explain what you mean by the three different voting systems?
Sure. Madam Chair, so we have three, I guess you could technically say four voting systems. One is election systems and software is the vendor, and 32 of the 36 counties in the state use ES&S products, and those are a fill-in-the-box next to the names. Two counties use a HART, the HART system, which again it's a fill in a box, and those names are are printed underneath the candidate's name. There's the Sequoia system, which connects a head and tail of an arrow for those ballots to be counted, and there's a derivative of that that's used in Marion County. So each county is free to choose their own voting system. It has to be certified by us that it meets certain standards to be used, so that's. Each one of them has different software and different parameters on their ballot that has an impact on what how many characters they can take on the line and how the ballot is actually laid out and submitted to the voters.
Thanks.
So for the abbreviations, one of the overriding concerns was we wanted to make sure that there was uniformity throughout the state. Especially with respect to, we have many, we have, I think, 19 different versions of our voters' pamphlet, and so some of those cross-county lines, and so we wanted to make sure that everybody had the same information throughout the state as far as what they were voting on, and so we applied that three-letter abbreviation uniformly throughout the state. We solicited from the parties what three-letter abbreviation they would like to see, and so we received those. We committed to printing on every single ballot a key, which would identify what the three-letter abbreviation was relative to the party name, so that there would be no voter confusion and that they would have the ability to know what those abbreviations were. We also printed a key on the bottom of facing pages in the voter's pamphlet on every page where a candidate appeared. There was information on the abbreviations in the secretary's letter in the beginning of the voter's pamphlet, so I think we did a really good job of communicating the issue of the abbreviations to the voters. Now, after this abbreviation rule was put forward, I had confidence that I was applying this rule evenly because I think every party in the state was unhappy with me. Mm-hmm. But in order to make this happen, we needed to change something and to come up with these abbreviations. So with that, that started part of the process of dueling legal opinions. I know that Legislative Council was asked for an opinion, and they concluded that we did not have the authority to issue this rule. My lawyers are at the Attorney General's office, and when I counseled with them, they said that this was the most legally defensible position for us to take, given the implementation challenges in the statute. And so we went forward. There weren't any legal challenges there. But then two lawsuits have been filed and currently remain relating to this process. One was on the use of the abbreviations in Marion County Circuit Court. There was an attempt to get that changed before the election, and the court refused to do that, but the court has not yet ruled on the merits. And then there's been a subsequent case filed in the Court of Appeals just challenging the rulemaking process that we went through in adopting this rule. Now, as far as feedback, my office and the county clerks did not receive one single call from a voter that had any that was confused by the abbreviations. The very few calls that we did receive, which was about two dozen, most of those comments were that they were upset that there were multiple parties because they really wanted to know which party this candidate was a member of. Not a very representative sample. There was hardly any response or calls coming in. Like I said, none as far as people being confused. Their biggest issue was wanting to find out which party the candidate was of the two or three that were listed next to their name. So, with that, like I said, there's still two lawsuits pending. The rule is still in effect, and as the law stands today, that's what will go forward into the future. I know there's legislation, I believe, in both houses that deals with different issues of this process that will be dealt with in the coming weeks, I know. But that's really, you know, the path that we've been through and where we are today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you would have.
And it looks like the legislation called for you to not only report but offer any recommended legislative changes, and it sounds like though there are bills that deal with this topic, you didn't initiate any of them. Is that right?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We haven't, and I think the biggest issue in all of this is the statutory language that requires for the party name to be printed opposite the name, because with the different voting systems, there's different challenges and constraints there, and I understand the policy goal and objective is to keep that party name associated with the candidate, but I think there's some ways that with the different voting systems now that could be loosened and still have make sure that the name is associated with the candidate. For example, printing it underneath and tabbed over next to the name, that would be easier for many of the voting systems.
Madam Chair.
Okay, yes, Senator Farioli has a question.
If you refer to the AP style book, you know, any newspaper article has the party affiliation in parentheses associated with the name. So maybe that would be an option because people are familiar with that form. So, you know, my name quoted in a newspaper, for instance, would be Senator Ted Farioli, parens R-John Day, or just R into parentheses. So it would be a way to delineate without adding any, you know, placement issues or gaps. You know, maybe that would help clarify.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, you know, that's, again, you know, paren, you know, letter, paren doesn't take any more letters, and you know, it's all about, I think, what you believe is the easiest for the voters to understand. My objective in coming up with the abbreviations was to give as much information as I could within those parameters, because there was suggestion that we just go with the one letter for some parties and two letters for others, and I thought, you know, out of caution, the easiest thing to do was to open that up to the parties and give them three letters, because I knew three letters would fit. But be happy to do whatever style that you would recommend, as long as it fits within the character limits that the voting systems have for those voting systems that we have in the state.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Trout? Okay, it looks like you've answered them all. So, thank you very much for reporting, and I'm sure we'll have further discussion on this topic.
Thank you, I'm sure we will.
Okay, I will close the informational meeting on the report from the Secretary of State on Crest nomination and open an informational meeting for an overview and evaluation report on the Citizens Initiative Review Commission. And Erin, did you have anything to introduce this topic, or should we just call
I would defer to the co-directors of the Healthy Democracy Oregon.
Okay, then I will call Elliot Schuford and Tyrone Reitman, if you'd like to come forward and kick off this presentation. That would be great. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Osborne. So, Chair Rosemont, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tyrone Reitman, co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. It's very good to be before you all this afternoon. Some members have been on this committee since we started working on the Citizens Initiative Review in 2007. Some members have not. So we thought it'd be good to just provide some background information about the Citizens Initiative Review and kind of where we're coming from with this project. Because we've done a lot of work over the last 4 years and have made a lot of progress on it, working with members of both the House Rules Committee and the Senate Rules Committee. So we chose to undertake this project because of the simple fact that the quality of information around ballot measure campaigns is often poor, and often that's intentional. So the result of having poor information around ballot measure campaigns is that voters oftentimes report back that ballot measures are too complex or confusing to know what will happen if they're passed. Poll after poll also demonstrates that voters lack confidence in their own vote, oftentimes casting ballots on measures that they're unfamiliar with. And that's not to say that we don't all do the best we can with the information that we have, but our point here is to make what we've got a whole lot better. So at the same time that voters express confusion and lack of confidence around ballot measure campaigns, by and large, again, study after study over the years, Oregonians widely support having an initiative process, as we should. It's part of our political DNA, it's a hallmark of our democratic process, and it's a right that without doubt Oregonians take seriously. So the question really becomes, how do you get better information to voters in a way that would actually inform and not just influence? So this presentation is about doing just that, how you get information to voters in a way that they'll actually want to use it and in a way that's trustworthy and fair. So in 2007, we began this effort by working on a bill to create the Citizens Initiative Review. We met with legislators in that session, and the feedback that we received was, you know, this is an interesting idea, let's actually see it in action. So in 2008, Healthy Democracy Oregon ran a field test of the initiative review process on then ballot measure 58, which is a limitation on bilingual education in public schools. We had Bill Sizemore there to represent the proponent for the measure and the Defend Oregon Coalition there to oppose the measure. And across the board, the marks we received was that it was a fair process. I think it's probably one of the few times that those parties really agreed on much. So having shown that the process would work, we came back to the legislature in 2009 to take the next logical step, which was to convene a pilot of the Citizens Initiative Review in order to give voters the opportunity to use this new source of information by putting it in a prominent new space in the Voters Guide, and then also conducting a rigorous study to determine if this was actually useful information. So are voters going to use it, and is it useful? So we ran that pilot in August of 2010 on ballot measure 73, which is a mandatory minimum sentencing measure, and measure 74, which is to legalize medical marijuana dispensaries in the state. And the National Science Foundation put in $218,000 to conduct the study of the Citizens Initiative Review to see what impact it had. And that's the focus of the presentation today. And we have a number of speakers with us for this presentation, including Dr. John Gastel, who led the research team, the NSF-funded research team. Dr. Gastel is nationally acknowledged as a leading researcher in the field of dialogue and deliberation and communications. And we're also very pleased to have two of the panelists from the 2010 review here as well. We have Marion Sharp from Tigard, who participated in the review of ballot measure 73, and Greg Casimir from Bend, who participated in the review of ballot measure 74. And we're grateful they could all be with us today for this presentation. So before we get a whole lot further, what we'd like to do is show a video of the Citizens Initiative Review. This is from the 2008 field test. It does a really good job of just concisely explaining why do the review and how does the review work. Following that, Dr. Gastel will discuss the NSF-funded evaluation of the review process. Mary and Greg will be up here to answer your questions and talk about their experience being part of the inaugural Citizens Initiative Review. And then HDO's other co-director, Elliot Shuford, and I will be back up here to talk about legislation that we're currently working on to make the CIR permanent. So with that, I think we can probably kick on the video.
This is what it's about. It's about getting information. It's about making a decision. If this diverse group can do this, why can't this be the model for doing business in America?
Every 2 years at election time, Oregonians are faced with tough choices about ballot measures. These measures have been a central feature of Oregon politics for over 100 years. Adopted in 1902, the initiative process enables everyday citizens to gather signatures of their fellow voters to put measures on the statewide ballot. The initiative has played a major role in Oregon's history. And ballot measures continue to play a major role in Oregon state politics today. Since the 2000 election, voters have decided on ballot measures which have had fiscal impacts of over $50 billion in new spending and tax cuts. Voters have also made decisions about major social policies like health care, the environment, same-sex marriage, and election reform. Over the past 10 years, campaigns for and against ballot measures have spent over $100 million to influence voters. Given that the stakes are so high, campaigns turn to the most efficient ways to win the vote, and as a result, poll-tested messages and catchy sound bites dominate the debate. This fills the airwaves with political noise, full of half-truths and spin.
Another way to take your dough.
Oregonians are tired of this. Since the 2007 legislative session, Healthy Democracy Oregon has been promoting the Citizens Initiative Review, a reform to the initiative process designed to provide voters with trustworthy, concise, and easily accessible information about ballot measures. The proposal is to have each initiative measure on the ballot put through a high-quality public review prior to the election. The review brings together a panel of randomly selected registered voters from across the state to hear from both the pro and con sides of the ballot measure, as well as background witnesses. Each measure is reviewed by a separate panel, and the results from each review then go into a concise, one-page statement in a prominent new place in the voter's pamphlet, ensuring each voting household has access to the results. Oregonians like the Citizens Initiative Review. To date, over 30,000 Oregonians from across the state have signed a statement of support for the review. In September 2008, following the recommendation of lawmakers and initiative advocates, Healthy Democracy Oregon organized a demonstration of the Citizens Initiative Review to show how the process works. The subject of the review was Ballot Measure 58, a limitation on how long students can receive English as a second language instruction in Oregon.
In order to succeed here, they need to learn English.
The panel heard 5 full days of public testimony from campaign advocates, policy experts, and background witnesses.
So are we clear on the fact that 85% of the kids are already learning in English, all in English?
National experts presented via telephone.
When the whole issue of bilingual education came up in the media, it really never made any sense to me.
The panel came from a large pool of randomly selected Oregon voters, and then in a public process overseen by the Oregon League of Women Voters, the panel was carefully balanced to match the demographics of the state's voters. The review was moderated by 2 highly trained professional mediators. The panel deliberated in small groups and identified their most important questions for advocates and other presenters to answer. Each day, the review was evaluated by the panelists and the advocates to document any perceived bias or problems with the process. The results of the evaluation show the panelists and both the pro and con advocate teams all found the review to be fair and free from bias. On the fourth day, the panel discussed the measure in an open, large group format.
Sometimes when you're too close to the subject, you can't make rules that are best for it.
I have been took a very strong position of a pro, but I've since had a chance to visit with the 2 ladies on my left, and they've somewhat influenced me, so I'm back on the fence again.
To me, the 2 years suddenly didn't seem founded in fact. If their major source of information says, no, it can take 3.
I just got a lot of information, and I'm still digesting what everybody said because everybody has made some very valid points.
On the final day, the panel broke into 2 groups, those supporting the measure and those opposing, and wrote the citizen's statement. To conclude the process, the panel then presented their statement on the steps of the Capitol. In the end, 9 panelists supported the measure.
We support Ballot Measure 58 for the following reasons.
and 14 panelists opposed the measure.
We oppose Measure 58 because it will not save taxpayer dollars and will not...
Following the success of the 2008 field test, Healthy Democracy Oregon worked with a bipartisan team of legislators to pass House Bill 2895, the Citizens Initiative Review Pilot. The bill calls for the review of 1 to 3 measures on the 2010 general election ballot. The bill also provides prominent new pages in the official statewide voters pamphlet for the citizen statements. The purpose of the 2010 pilot is to provide Oregonians an opportunity to use this new information and determine through a rigorous evaluation how much voters value the Citizens Initiative Review as a new public service. The National Science Foundation will fund the evaluation with a $200,000 research grant.
Wow.
It is about the people, and I've always, you know, we need to come together on a lot of issues.
Well, you guys, I found faith in the regular Joe voter.
And it renewed my faith in the ability of our citizens to make good decisions.
The Citizens Initiative Review Pilot is a tremendous opportunity for the state of Oregon to improve the initiative process in an innovative and fair manner, putting quality citizen deliberation at the center of the Citizens Initiative process. At our website, you can learn more about this proposal, sign up to receive the results of the reviews, and find out how you too can support this work. We encourage you to support the Citizens Initiative Review and lead the way to a healthier democracy.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Elliot Shuford, co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. We're happy to take questions now, or we can save those until later in the presentation after Professor Gastel has had a chance to talk about the evaluation. So,
why don't we hear about the evaluation, and great, then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is John Gastel. I'm a professor of communication at the University of Washington in Seattle. I've been studying public deliberation for over 20 years. My first book, Democracy in Small Groups, in 1993, addressed the issue of how to deliberate in a small group. And The Jury in Democracy, published just this last year, is a book looking at deliberation in probably the oldest citizen deliberation body in the world. The Oregon Citizens Initiative Review is a unique process, and the reason I was drawn to it is to understand how deliberation would work in a process that was relatively prominent. You might call it a relatively high-stakes process. The pilot you just saw from a couple years back was just that, a pilot. But in 2010, you actually ran a process here in the state of Oregon that had a means of reaching the larger electorate through the voters' pamphlet. That was unique and special, and I thought merited study. Fortunately, the National Science Foundation agreed and funded this study principally, but so did the University of Washington, looking past its interstate rivalry with Oregon, saw its way to adding additional funding, which made possible a second survey to complement the one we were doing with the National Science Foundation. So here's what I'm going to do today. Just a quick overview is we're going to look at the report, basically. I'm going to give you a few highlights. Some of the slides will even reference page numbers. And there are three sections of that report. The first is on the quality of the deliberative process, looking at how the participants themselves felt about it, and also, as experts looking in on it, what we thought of the process. The second section is where we're going to focus our attention. That's on the utility of it. Did voters actually become aware of it? Did they find the CIR statements to be important? And ultimately, did it have an impact on their views and their knowledge of the issues? The third section, the recommendations, I'm only going to mention just briefly. These recommendations are as much for whoever implements the CIR in coming years as it is for a committee or a legislature considering renewing legislation. product. Let's start by evaluating the CIR deliberative process itself. You already have a sense for how this process works based on your prior knowledge and the video and introduction you just saw. So let's just kind of jump right into how the participants thought about it. What you see are a couple graphics up there. On the left, you have measure 73. On the right, measure 74. This is from page 11 in the report. And I want to draw your attention to two different satisfaction ratings. Look at measure 73. You have end-of-week and follow-up ratings. End-of-week means just that. On Friday, the last day of the process, you can see that 14 of the panelists were very satisfied, 9 were satisfied, and 1 was, neutral. We then wanted to check back with the panelists on a range of issues, including this, and we did so in late October. So a couple months later, do they still feel the same way? They've had a chance to reflect on it, think about the election, and so on. And basically, you get the same result with a slight moderation of their enthusiasm, but basically satisfaction across the board, with one exception in the case of both issues. One person actually unsatisfied on measure 73, and one neutral on 74 in that follow-up. Compared to other deliberative processes I've seen, there's not that much follow-up data, but this is pretty consistent, that people tend to have the same sense of the quality of the deliberation long after the process is over. How about whether they'd heard enough information? Because what the CIR does is it forces people to come to terms with a complex issue not having any prior knowledge. It's something that voters are always forced to do, but without the luxury of a week to study and hear from a range of different witnesses. What you have here is their assessment of whether they'd learned enough to really feel like they'd made an informed decision. And again, you have two time points. You have the end-of-week assessment and the follow-up, and you get basically the same result, that overwhelmingly the panelists really felt that they had enough information now to make the simple choice of whether to really come out in favor or opposed to these issues. I would say one note here is sometimes that number went up considerably by the last day. That is, starting out in the process, voters didn't necessarily feel as informed and felt that they needed to know more. But by the end of a week, as you might guess, they felt that they had a pretty good handle on it, at least relative to what a voter needs to make that simple choice. How about their positions before and after? Again, we have measure 73 here on the left, measure 74 on the right, and this is just before and after. I should say that the before is retrospective. We deliberately didn't want to get into detailed political polling with panelists before they had gone into this process. So we asked them retrospectively, where were you when you started this week and where are you now? You can see that on both issues, overwhelmingly, people beforehand really weren't sure. They were undecided on the issues. By the end, on measure 73, they were overwhelmingly opposed. And on measure 74, they were pretty evenly split, which happily matches up with what was actually presented in the CIR statements. Were that not so, it would have been a matter of some small concern. Now we move to an expert assessment. It's great to know that the panelists thought the process was valuable, that they felt they were informed and they were satisfied by the end. But what did we think as observers? And the we is myself, Katie Knobloch, and Justin Reedy, doctoral candidates at the University of Washington, and Catherine Kramer-Walsh, a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We watched every last minute of these 5-day proceedings, and it was brutal to watch. Deliberation, I've always said, is an incredibly engaging process if you're in it, and it's not so entertaining to watch if you're not. But we did. Trust me, it does not make great television. And what we came up here with was a way of translating our trust me, hopelessly complex academic interpretations of what happened into basically a report card on the different elements of deliberation and how the process fared. In general, as you've probably seen in our summary, we gave it a pretty strong grade. The deliberation was of high quality, but here in my remarks, I'm just going to make a couple notes about things that didn't get even to the threshold of an A-. First, about information. Did they learn basic information, and did they really seem to comprehend it? From our perspective, that's kind of a B+. There were clearly times that things were confusing. The process would seem to break down a little bit. Everyone would have to slow down and try to ferret out the facts. There was at one point, in fact, on Measure 73 early on, where the advocates from both sides actually just tried to explain some terms and concepts that they could agree upon because the issue was so complex. And these things generally went well, but we think they could have gone better. Something I think you'll see in our recommendations is we actually think that the advocates testifying for and against the issues have the most ground they could move forward in terms of improving performance. This was a new process. They are not trained to have to make a sustained argument for several days in a row to a group of randomly selected citizens. That's a tough task. They were very tough on information, and they wanted everything in their binder. And if you had an argument, you have to get ready for the counter-argument, and then the counter to that. Again, you just keep having to follow up, and that was a real challenge. So the information, I think, was sometimes a little bit jumbled because the advocates were doing something new. And again, weren't prepared for that depth of deliberation, which I think optimistically in the future we will see a better engagement, and I think those scores would rise. The other thing we gave a lower grade on was examining underlying values. The process is very much built to look at information, empirical observations. You talk about values and sort of big concerns, but it's not really built into the process, I don't think, in a very strong way right now. And value considerations are one of the most important things for us as voters, and they're tied to information. Information tells us the impact of something that is relevant to our values. So that aspect of the process, I think, will be refined and improved in coming years. But now I want to turn to the actual utility for Oregon voters. To say the process was deliberative is fine, but the question that was of most interest to the reviewers at the National Science Foundation and to most colleagues I talked to is, fine, okay, we know people can deliberate. You know, the jury system actually has a pretty good track record in this regard, for instance. This is a different kind of deliberation, but does it really have an impact? In particular, does it reach beyond the people who were present for this process? Well, again, that's what makes Oregon special. And this isn't the first time your state has done an innovation that I think other states are ultimately going to copy, and they'll start to seem old hat. No one will know it came from Oregon. But for now, Oregon is the only state to put this kind of deliberative process in the official voter's guide. That's really potentially a key factor, depending on, again, how voters actually use that. So in the voter's guide, you know the basic structure of what's in there, the majority and minority opinion, and the key findings that are presented. Well, did voters really come to find that page? Did they even become aware of the CIR? What you're looking at now is the phone survey that the University of Washington helped fund for us. This is a rolling cross-sectional survey, meaning every week we were interviewing a new group of people in the state of Oregon to find all kinds of information, including just basic awareness. So the dark green bar you see, it means that they're very aware of the CIR, and the light green means they are at least somewhat aware. As you can see, from the first week of September, after the CIR process was complete, you've only got about 20 to 30% of Oregonians even aware of the CIR. When the voter's pamphlet comes out, that number goes up quite a bit to 42%, and very aware reaches its peak of 16% right up in the final week before the election. It still doesn't reach 50%, let's be clear. You can ask whether the glass is half empty or half full, and I will tell you it's 42% full. Well, again, relative to expectations, I don't know what that is, but I do think it's reasonable to presume that as this process becomes more embedded in Oregon's political DNA, to take a metaphor from earlier, that number would rise. It would be something that people would come to expect and would recognize when they saw it. An alternative point of view might be that its novelty is what got it a 42% awareness, and that might die off. Only time would tell on that because, again, this process is unique. But, again, I think the experience from the past is that when you have an innovation such as the voter's pamphlet itself, its adoption and awareness rate begins low and then increases as people become more familiar with it. It's another piece of data we could look at later that addresses this as well, which is, for instance, at one point in the report, I talk about, well, who was aware of it? People wanted to know who would find out about it and who wouldn't. And for the most part, it was pretty broadly distributed across the population, that awareness or lack of awareness, with one exception. If you look at age, for voters over 60, only 27% in the end became aware of the CIR. 41 to 60 years of age, 47%, and under 40 years and under, 65%. That's from 27% to 65%. So it was younger voters who were more aware of the CIR. Now, some people will say that's just Facebook and Twitter, and they're also wonderfully connected. Maybe. But I think it also has something to do with the fact that older voters have voted for many years and know what's in the voter's guide. And if there's something new, they may very well miss it. It's not something they're accustomed to even wanting to look for. So the CIR might, to a younger voter in Oregon, for instance, someone turning 18, they might say, oh, sure, we have that. I assume we always have. When, in fact, it's brand new. The other survey we conducted was an online survey. Here we got a random sample of people in collected by a firm called Polymetrics. And what they do is they use these panels of people where it's relatively easy to survey them repeatedly over time. And as you'll see in a later part of this report, this panel was very useful for that very reason. We could survey them before the CIR and then after. The statistic I wanted to show you here is this group, we were asking sort of intensive questions about how they used that voter's pamphlet. And the Secretary of State had requested from us some of this information just about general use of the pamphlet. We've passed that on to them months ago. They found it very useful and encouraging that Oregonians overwhelmingly do want to use their voter's pamphlet. But how much time do they spend reading the different sections? Here you can see the CIR relative to other parts of the voter's guide relevant to an initiative. And you can see that they're actually reporting a little over 10 minutes reading that CIR page for an initiative, which is more than twice as much, or any of these two combined. It's a little bit more than that. Now, whether they're actually reading it for 11 minutes, I cannot say. That's what they tell us. What I can tell you is that they recall reading it much more than they do any other element. So if 11 is 11, I can't say. But they are subjectively and probably accurately recalling that they spent more time with it than they did any other part of the voter's guide on that issue. How about the importance of the findings for deciding how to vote on the measure? Here you can look at the results for Measure 73, and I broke these results down among three groups. And remember, these are the folks we get to survey twice. So they're in the first group on the left, that bar, is for those who, when we surveyed them before, long before the election, did they initially oppose Measure 73? And you can see that 92% of those, by the end of the election, when we surveyed them again, said, yeah, you know, I found that CIR statement really helpful. Those in favor initially of 73, you might think, well, they wouldn't find it helpful because the CIR statement was actually quite critical of Measure 73, but 82% of them said, yeah, I actually found it to be quite useful. You notice only half as many said it was very important, but again, overwhelmingly, voters were saying they found it important. Measure 74, you might expect a little bit of the opposite. And in fact, it's true that among those initially opposed to Measure 74, the lowest percentage found the CIR important, but 76% is the low number. So again, three-quarters are finding the CIR helpful, even if it seemed to maybe go against their initial impression. More on that later. Measure 74, I think, is particularly interesting because the CIR panel was closely divided on that issue. When you read the statement, you get pro and con arguments, and you see that the vote was 13 to 11 in favor. Well, how does a voter interpret something that close? We'll get to that by the end of this presentation. Now, before I go to that next slide, I just want to back up for a second and say one of the things that we decided to do with this study was to actually incorporate an experimental element. Now, when you say experiment sometimes in the social sciences, you think of a lab experiment with undergraduates doing God knows what. No, this is what we call a highly ecologically valid field experiment. Bear with me. In the follow-up survey to the online panelists, we took a subset of those folks, everyone who said no to the following questions. Have you already voted? No. Have you already read the voter's pamphlet? No. If you said no twice, you're in our experiment. You are then assigned to one of four random conditions. One quarter of you got nothing, and the next question you get asked is, how would you vote on Measure 73, the measure that we then use the title to describe what it is, and we find out how they would vote. Randomly, you might have been assigned to a second group, which was functionally quite like the first, but we said, okay, hold on for a second, we'd like you to read this page. And again, it's an online survey, so this works well. They see a PDF of the introductory page in the voter's pamphlet. There's a letter from the Secretary of State explaining, you know, what the political parties are. Totally useless to what we're about to ask you, but at least you have to stop and read something. This is how experiments are done. The next condition, fair bit more useful. These folks actually are getting the summary and fiscal statement on Measure 73. Again, we stop them, say, please read this PDF. They read that, and then they're asked how they would vote. And the fourth condition, you know where this is going, they get the CIR page on Measure 73. So what do you expect to see across those four conditions? Again, they're identical groups because of the random assignment. And here's what you get. If you got nothing, you just got asked the question, overwhelmingly 69% say I would vote for Measure 73. If you got the letter from the Secretary of State, not at all germane, but we made you read something, 66%. If you get the summary in the fiscal statement, 66%. If you get the CIR statement, it's a dramatic change of over 25% shift. Now, that's pretty compelling evidence by a lot of social scientific standards. What it doesn't tell you is why they shifted. And there's a couple interesting follow-up questions I'll just mention here briefly, which is one of the things you see with the CIR condition is that people actually became a little hesitant. As social scientists, we tend to be kind of obnoxious when we ask survey questions. So we ask you, how would you vote? If your first response is, well, I'm not sure, what is our next thing? Oh, come on. You know, which way do you lean? Do you lean no? And, you know, you can still say, I don't know. Fine, we record that as a don't know. In the CIR condition, we had a substantially higher number of people who were hesitant to give that first answer. In other words, the CIR statement had introduced doubt. When they were followed up, as you can see, the number who said, I guess I would have to say no at this point, had gone up quite a bit. When you ask them if they feel, how confident they feel about the information they have and so on, the summary and fiscal statement is the one that shoots people's confidence up. Again, they're voting the same as people who got no information, but they were feeling very confident at that point. The people who read the CIR statement weren't necessarily confident. That, again, an element of doubt and needing to reconsider the issue had appeared to have entered their mind. So the reason I bring this up is, again, interpreting a finding like this is sometimes challenging. It certainly appears to be the case that the CIR statement doesn't make people's minds up for them so much as it causes people to back up and maybe reconsider the issue. Another thing we can look at is knowledge gains. Again, with the online survey, we can actually try to ferret out what people knew beforehand versus what they knew after the fact. And with the phone survey, we can do various statistical controls to try to get a sense for whether reading that page is associated with increases in knowledge, controlling for other things like general political knowledge and so on. And without going through the details here, basically, there were about 8 of these knowledge items where you could see a significant increase in knowledge. All of these would be accurate increases in knowledge, with the possible exception of actually the last one on Measure 74. Current law forces many medical marijuana users to the black market. That's an interesting finding that people who read the CIR statement came to believe that, because that's actually not addressed in the CIR statement. It might be something that you feel is implied, because if there is apparently a need for medical marijuana among some people, presumably there's some inherent barrier to them getting it. So that might have caused an increase in the perception that many people are blocked from reaching it and having to go to the black market. The last thing I want to give you is something I call kind of a summary estimate of influence. Here we incorporate both of the surveys and actual election results, and we try to estimate roughly what percentage of the public supported these measures with or without any awareness of the Oregon CIR. If you look at Measure 73, for instance, on mandatory sentencing, to the best of our knowledge, based on polling and the actual election result, about 66% of people who were unaware of the CIR, and remember, that's a small majority of Oregon voters, 66% were in favor of the measure. Those who were aware of the CIR but didn't spend as much time with it were probably split about 50-50 on the issue. And those who actually read the CIR statement thoroughly wound up with only about a third probably supporting that measure. If you look at Measure 74, remember I said we'd get back to this one in a minute. 74 was the one where the CIR panel was split. And I know that a concern some people might have is, well, if it votes 13-11 in favor of something, that's not a ringing endorsement. Are voters just going to follow the 13, which, you know, but for one vote could have been an even split or even flip the other way? Well, voters who were unaware of the CIR probably were about 47% in favor of the measure. In other words, it was failing even with those who didn't read the CIR. Those who read it casually were actually less supportive of it. And finally, those who read it thoroughly, it looks like as few as something like 32% were in favor. In other words, reading a CIR statement that is evenly split on an issue appears, at least based on this limited sample of 2 cases, appears to be quite damning. As a voter, the logic seems to be that if you've got good arguments on both sides of the issue and the public who carefully considers this issue winds up pretty well split, that's not a good sign. That appears to be a piece of legislation that probably needs work. One of the interesting long-term implications of the CIR that I think you might come to see in Oregon, and it might take just as long as one election cycle, is the quality of the initiatives that come before the state. If you know that you have to go through the gauntlet of a CIR panel, it might actually have an influence on the quality of the legislation you write, with an eye towards, again, this sort of careful scrutiny that is not historically part of the electoral process. last slide here, and just a couple observations by way of conclusion. First, again, just a quick summary. It did meet a high standard for deliberation, and many voters did, in fact, find it helpful for thinking about how to vote on Measures 73 and 4, and we saw real knowledge gains there. I mentioned that there's a third section of the report that's recommendations. Again, perhaps more for the people who implement it than for the legislature itself, but I thought you'd be interested in seeing a couple of those. The first one I mentioned here is that, again, I think the witnesses and the advocates need to be more thoroughly prepared for their appearance before the panel. That's probably going to be critical to improve the quality and precision of the information they bring and just the organization of their argument. Probably it will be necessary to start preparing for these even earlier, perhaps even before we know what has qualified for the ballot. It might be necessary for organizers to start arranging the two sides of the issue and possibly even giving them a training on how to engage in this kind of deliberation, which unfortunately is not a commonplace activity in the initiative process. Second, there's a shared agreement section in the citizen statement. I imagine you haven't heard much about it. That's because, frankly, I don't think there's much to it at this point. It could be a neat chance for the 24 panelists to say what they agree about beyond simply saying we all had a good time, thanks for the ride, but it hasn't really been ferreted out what exactly that part of the statement will do. And then finally, I think some formatting for the statement is in order. I know the Secretary of State's office was very reluctant in this first round to do more than make it look like a phone book page, but probably a little bit of highlighting and bold and so on would make it a much more user-friendly page. It is packed with information, and the different elements of the statement are actually quite different. A way of even just boxing the text would be helpful with that, or at least giving the implementers the latitude to make those decisions on their own. On that note, I'd like to thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and member of the committee, for being here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you or your other members may have written for you.
So I wanted to ask you, I think it's your slide just before this last one, where you show the breakdown and kind of the change in support opposition based on how thoroughly people had read the statement. Do you think there's some self-selection going on in those who would actually thoroughly read a statement? I mean, if you already had your mind strongly made up, would you be less inclined to really take the time to read something like this?
Well, that's where statistical controls come into hand. With the online panel group, we can actually control for their initial, you know, support or opposition to see whether or not that was influencing, right, whether they would get to it. In the cross-sectional survey, we don't have before and after data for them. But we can control for instance, their party affiliation, their level of political knowledge, their interest in politics, and so on. And controlling for those factors tends to isolate the variable of interest, which is, did you read the statement? It's always possible that there's some question we didn't include in our survey, right, that is correlated with those two things. Mm. That's one of the reasons why, again, I was so happy that the University of Washington funded a different kind of survey. So we actually not only have the election result, but we have two very different kinds of survey data, which we triangulated to come up with these. And let me stress, those numbers are estimates. There are confidence intervals around those numbers. But it's a way of kind of reconciling the surveys and the election to a plausible result. If you do the numbers on this, it comes out to the election result. So again, it matches the data, but we can't be that precise, really.
Okay. So I don't see any other questions, but thank you very much for the summary, and we'll certainly take a look at the full report when we have a little more time.
Thank you for the opportunity to come here today.
And I think then we were next going to hear from the two folks that actually participated in one of these processes, and that would be Greg Casimir and Marion Sharp, if you want to come forward. And you will need to reintroduce yourself according to our protocol here, and then I don't know if you've decided which one of you wants to go first, but...
fighting on who goes second.
Okay, great.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Greg Casimir. I reside in Bend, Oregon, and I'm here to represent the Citizens for a Healthy Oregon Democracy. And what I'd like to start with is just to share a little bit of why I believe that this is really a valuable resource to the citizens of the state of Oregon. When I went to this process, I was on the marijuana initiative, and I was really skeptical. Where are they going with this, you know, and what are they trying, what's their agenda? And as I got to meet the mediators and the people that were involved in the process, the administrators, facilitators, I rapidly began to see that they really had a vision, that they really wanted to enhance the knowledge that Oregon voters had on these ballot measures. And by nature, I'm an investigator. I want to dig deep, and I want to know the truth, and I kind of want to make sure that the details are in order. And I saw the facilitators being very impartial, dealing with both sides, making sure the time was used well. The administrators came up with this idea, I think, in college. And the process has just grown. Anyway, my statement's going to be kind of letting you know why I think it's a valuable resource and why I think it's so. And the Citizens Initiative review process, we had 24 people from various walks of life. We had preachers, police officers. We had people that had been in and out of the penitentiary. We had people that were alcoholics. We had people that were lifetime drug users, marijuana users. So we had this, I mean, an unbelievable gamut of people. I mean, and a lot of us were very opinionated when we started. A lot of us swayed back and forth, saw valuable deals on both sides of the ballot measure. I started out very much opposed, and I could see some real need. I would never prohibit anybody that needs medical marijuana from having medical marijuana if there's a process to get it to them. So it wasn't like I'm just anti-drugs, but it was just like there's got to be a process for this thing to happen. And that's kind of where I started. And to be honest with you, when I got done, I'm rock solid on my position. I mean, I'm just, it'd take an atomic bomb to blow me up and change my DNA and totally change me to change my position now. But it's because of the information that we developed on that particular issue. And the process, we were there for 5 days. Most of the stuff you already know. But we got to read and evaluate the measure. And to be honest with you, the district attorney came in and we pointed out something to him. And he goes, well, I haven't seen that in the measure yet. The panel, the people that actually wrote the measure, were saying, well, we'd have worded that better if we understood it that way. You know, things aren't normally, you have to understand laws that are presented aren't written that well. They do it later on in the process. They fine-tune the law. I go, no, this is the law. And anyway, so we worked through that, and both sides, I think, saw the importance of being prepared when they came to speak and share their information. We got to design and frame our questions for the witnesses, which I think is really important. They weren't selected questions that we had to ask, or it wasn't really formatted. 24 people's minds are spinning, and they're trying to come up with their ideas and positions. And we got to select additional witnesses. The panel, after the original committee had brought their witnesses in, we got to go out and select more witnesses to come in and bring in the testimony. And the last witness just testified that there was some discrepancy in the amount of material we got. The only thing that our panel missed was we were trying to get a person from the state of Oregon. He's a high-ranking official inside the government, and he refused to testify before, said it was a conflict of interest. And so we couldn't get him, and I think several of us were willing to come up to the come up here, not talk to the legislature, but actually go to the governor and say, we want this man, we need this information, we need to know what he's going to do when it comes time if this bill passes. But that was the only information we weren't obtained. They went to great lengths to get us the information we needed, and there's just some things that are beyond our control, and we can't have everything we want, you know. What this really did for me was it helped me see myself in a different light. I have been one of those voters that voted that wasn't well-informed. It was kind of an emotional vote. I didn't necessarily even read the measure. I'm one of those, on measure 73, I was definitely pro mandatory sentencing on the sex crimes and the DUI, even though they were lumped together, which I thought was kind of strange. But after I read their deal and did some investigation and stuff, there was enough for me to change my position on my vote. So It's making me look at ballot measures in a different way. I've shared with literally hundreds of people the CIR process. And most people, by the time I get done explaining to them, they go like, how can I get involved? You know, can they select me? I want to go sit on that. I want to dig that deep and investigate it. And to me, the most important thing is my opinion of why the CIR process is necessary for Oregon. And I'm really concerned about Oregon and our process where just about anything can get on a ballot measure. I mean, you can just sign a petition and, boy, if you get enough signatures and everybody's documented and they're all registered voters, boom, you get this thing on the voter's pamphlet. It doesn't matter if it's good for Oregon, bad for Oregon, but, yeah, you can get it on the ballot. And the voters need credible information. And it's hard to get. When I've tried to investigate some of these measures and stuff that have been on the ballot, it's difficult to get quality information. Most of it, the people that write the ballot measure, they're driven. They have an agenda. And they're willing to take the statistics to match, to sell their point. I mean, so many of them were just, it was, they're giving you a very tainted deal, and it was almost all, everything's unbarred, take the bars off the window, we're coming through, and here's our information, and you got to believe it. It's this way, you know. And those who are opposed to the measure are guilty of the same thing. They're tainting their information to kind of make you think it's their way. So if you don't really know the whole story, you don't get it. Now you take 24 people, and you seal us up in a room, and you give them a ton of information, more than you can do in the 40 hours you have in this room. You can't even absorb it in that period of time. Personally, I'm like a college student. I'm in there highlighting everything and marking it and writing notes against it. And for putting it, they gave us a little tiny notebook to start with, and you're going like, that's not going to even begin to keep the information I need. And so then they give us a great big notebook. And anyway, the whole thing comes together. And the people, we had school teachers, and like I said, attorneys. We had just about every walk of life you can think of was in that room. And when they got done, we were sharing the information. I'd find something at night. I found an article down in Medford. I thought I was pretty impressed with this thing and been on the news broadcast down in Medford. I go like, hey, you guys got to read this. And I copied it so everybody I could talk into reading it would have it. The CIR process had it the next day. I mean, they were handing it out as a handout. So the thing is there's a lot of people, I'm not saying everybody, but there's a lot of people that were doing a lot of digging till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, trying to find out, is the information the witnesses gave us, is it credible? Is it from reliable sources? Or is it emotional? My grandmother has cancer and she needs medical marijuana. That's pretty emotional. I'm going like, how can we get it for her? You know? I mean, if she really truly needs it and a credible doctor will support her having it, I'm 100% in favor of her having it. Let's find out a way. But this bill was, you know, we were able to determine unanimously in the room, I believe it was unanimous, it might have been one vote short, you have to look at the statistics, but it's really close, that the bill was poorly written. Okay? Even the people that wrote the bill admitted it was poorly written. They even admitted it, that they wrote it intentionally that way. So I think the Oregon voters, I credit the Oregon voters for a lot of savvy to look at this 13-11 thing and say, wow, how do I go on this thing? But when you read the first statement in that bill that's unanimous from the both sides, opposed and pro, that it's poorly written, it's time to be, I think the Oregon voter said, I think they need to redraft that. They need to start over. And I just kind of wanted to give you a few things on my reflections as I pondered over this thing. It's been months now that I really kind of keep pondering on this thing going over and over and over again in my head. And the more I ponder on it, the more I'm convinced that this is a viable and a valuable resource for the citizens of the state of Oregon. Of all the people I've talked to, and I've shared my experiences on this committee, no one has ever said, well, that's a stupid idea. Who came up with that? They've wanted to be involved in it. They wanted to know how it happened, why I went from being a little definitely opposed, you know, kind of on against the issue to start with, to being just so rock solid. And several people that I've talked to, after I share the facts, share some of the information that I've written down, have totally switched their sides. they've come across to come back over. And it's to me, it's one of the most important things that I saw there was we get to be face-to-face with the witnesses. So it's like you get to look at me today and say, is he credible? Is he telling me the truth? Is he hesitant in his thoughts and his deliberation? Does what he say stack up with what really happened? You know, you get to view that with us, and we got to do that with the witnesses. So he had 24 citizens witnessing these people face-to-face. When they made a statement or a misstatement, we got to question it. We got to ask. You know, I mean, like you get the chance today, you'll have the chance to ask us, do you really believe that? Is that what really happened? You say that was unanimous. Are you sure of that? We got to question them like that. We got to ask those questions. We got to the truth. We got to listen to their voices. Were they cracking when they were telling their stories, were they telling their side? When you brought up something that would put them in the hot seat, you're almost calling them a liar. Did they get nervous and fidgety? Did they try to go someplace else with it? Were they looking over here going like, oh, geez, what do I do now? No. We got to sit there and watch them. That's one thing that's in that voter's pamphlet when we write that initiative, is you get that sense that those people were there. They actually got to do the investigation and the interviews themselves. I think when we look at the credibility and the follow-up questions that you get to ask face-to-face, which you guys get to do every day or close to it, you know what I'm talking about. And it's just so valuable. It is truly an asset. 24 people deliberating 5 days, reading the material, supporting documents, both pro and con, studying in the evenings and stuff, investigating the integrity of witnesses, interviewing the professional witnesses, several of them that we got to pick ourselves. You know that we're putting the best information we have available after 5 days of investigating a single ballot measure in that voter's pamphlet. And I guarantee you the number of words that we could put on that one page was not sufficient. It's totally insufficient. I mean, there were things like, and you're taking some of the most important things that citizens need to know, and you're leaving them off. But you got it. I don't know, I've taken college classes, and the advisor will say, Greg, I want you to put everything you read for 6 weeks in one sentence, no more than 13 words. And if you ever have done that, you know that it's really hard to put the most important thing. But that's what we're giving the voters. We left off some of the stuff that I thought was the most important because the other people on my position thought that the stuff that they had was more important. And it's fun to work together with people like that, even when you're rock solid in your position, but they have a different opinion of what's important. And say, okay, let's go with your position. That's great. And the group did that, and we were pro. When we got done, we went over and helped the con write their statements. Okay? So all 24 people contribute to both pro and con statements that are in there. So if they look at something that's weak that you've put in there, they'll explain to you why it's weak, and you go back and re-deliberate. It's a valuable process. I just really ask that you guys really consider this seriously. I'm a taxpayer here in the state of Oregon. And I really believe that these are dollars that are well spent. Thank you. And if you have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Do you want to ask your question now, or shall we wait till we hear the other?
Just a comment, if
okay.
I may.
Go ahead.
I really appreciate the time you did. I thought it was, and I wasn't in the legislature when they set these things up, but I thought it was one of the most valuable things the legislature has done a number of years around elections, so I thank you both for your participation. And I do have one question, and that's I'm curious, and I think I have gathered the answer. It strikes me from listening to you that when you went back, you talked a lot with your friends and neighbors and educated them, and I suspect that took a great deal of time of reading the other group's comments as well and put some faith in that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I literally shared it when I first got back with anybody that sit down and talk to me. I mean, I was excited and on fire. Since the election, that's kind of dropped off a little bit. But I still share when I get a chance. When somebody starts talking political stuff, I try to share the CIR process. And yes, the Measure 73 was the very specific place where I looked to the other side's opinion. By the time I got done with this panel, I didn't need to reread 74's position for against. But the 73, the mandatory sentencing and the DUI, mandatory sentencing, it didn't change my mind when I read it. But it made me say, Greg, you got to read this bill. You got to talk to some. And I was a state policeman throughout my career. I did 27 and a half years with the Oregon State Police. You need to talk to some of your DA friends. You need to talk to some of your judges and see what they think of this thing. Dig a little deeper. Read the measure itself to see what it really says. And the measure itself really coincided well with their opposition. And it totally changed my vote. I mean, I was a mandatory sentencing guru. But my vote would have been emotional. It would have been, I don't like some of the stuff that, of course, DUIs, I've dealt with those in throughout my life. Sex offenders, don't have a lot of sympathy for them. Mm-hmm. And that's emotional. But when you get down to mandatory sentencing and that measure and what it meant to the citizens of the state of Oregon and what it means to take that right away from the judge to make the decision based on all the evidence, my real heart came down to that judge has all the information. If he has, say, a 16-year-old sex offender, and he's got to put him for 25 years of mandatory sentencing by the statute, and he looks at the deal and says, this guy's a little slow. He made a mistake. It's a 14-year-old girl. Yeah, he qualifies, you know. Never did anything wrong in his life. Made a major, major, major mistake. Don't want to put him 2 years in probation and transfer him up to OSP, state penitentiary. You know, I think the judge needs to make that decision. I don't necessarily want to make that decision myself, but I think I want that judge to make that decision, and I don't think as a voter casting a vote that I should be making that decision for the judge. I think he needs to make it for himself. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got this one. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, committee member. I'm Marion Sharp. I thank you for this opportunity to be here. I live in Tigard. I've been in Oregon since August of 96, came here from Florida, so I consider myself a Floridian by birth and an Oregonian by choice. And we do not have the initiative process, at least at the point at which I left in Florida. So that has been a new experience for me here and something I've appreciated even before this. I'm going to build a little bit on what Greg has said. I have a lot of comments about the actual process and things that happened and awarenesses that I got that I get very excited about. But I'm going to focus a little bit more on kind of the ongoing impact. And yes, I did talk to a lot of people. I happen to be at Portland State, and so I drug Elliot over there on several occasions to talk to various groups and pass the word on and send it out to some email lists that I have. So, yes, I find myself talking about it a lot. And so part of my reflection is, and I wrote some things down so I could be really focused, I've been surprised by the positive impact of my experience as part of the Citizens Initiative Review this past summer. Greg said the same thing, and I suspect most of our group would say something like that. But I've been more surprised by the fact that this positive impact continues. It's not just from the first time, contrary to the data where it dropped off. For me, it has increased. It continues, and it increased. And I figured going in that it would be an interesting experience, but I honestly didn't expect it to necessarily be positive. I've been in group deliberations that haven't necessarily been a positive experience, so I wasn't confident that it would be a good experience. And I certainly didn't expect the positive impact to keep growing and getting larger. I see this citizens' initiative review process as an infrastructure project. It proposes to change some of the infrastructure around how the citizens' initiative process works, but I believe it goes beyond that. For me, it has changed my personal infrastructure, how I think about things, and the confidence I have that using the right process, all of our citizens can contribute effectively in solving any problem that we face. And certainly now we're facing some incredibly difficult problems. And further, the Citizens Initiative review process operates by changing the typical infrastructure of a committee process from one that is often conflicted to one that is effective. I'm sure that's not this committee, but I have been on committees where that would be true. And I believe that this can actually change the infrastructure of how our state operates for the better. I see this as starting with what we're talking about today, creating a system for reviewing the citizens' initiatives that are brought forward and providing careful feedback to the voters, but not ending there. I believe that the side effects of implementing this will produce an engaged and capable citizenry that can bypass the polarization that is so rampant today. The comments that I've heard over and over, there was no political flavor to either one of the groups. Greg and I talked about this before. We couldn't tell you who was on, who would have said they were an R or a D. It just wasn't relevant to the conversation. So how might that happen? Well, the Citizens Initiative Review provides a fair, careful, and balanced review of the initiatives brought forward by the citizens of Oregon. And it does that by engaging our citizens, this group that gets selected, in a carefully thought out and tested review process, and then providing the results of that review to all of Oregon. And it gives them, the participants in the review process, something they don't get anywhere else. It gives them direct experience in the democratic processes on which this country is founded. It is a form of deliberative democracy that we do not see anywhere else, at least at the moment. At least I certainly haven't seen it. I believe that if we adopt this process, not only will we improve the initiative process, which is the immediate goal, I believe we'll actually transform and strengthen our state in ways that no other state is doing. And other states are watching us. Now, the structure of the process is critical to its success. So as you move forward with this, it's essential that it stays in the hands of a neutral and balanced organization. Having watched and experienced the process, the participants will know, most likely instantaneously, if they or the process is being manipulated, or if their voice or an idea or suggestion is being ignored or excluded in any way. And if that's not acknowledged and repaired when the group or an individual in the group identifies it, and they will, believe me, then the credibility and value of the review process is in danger of being destroyed. So integrity matters. It's also essential that data continues to be collected on the process. I've had some wonderful conversations with John on the way down, and I'm really excited about the potential for more data to be gathered and more questions to be examined. By having that process in place, this will allow Oregon to demonstrate the effectiveness of this strategy and capture the effects that it produces across the citizenry. I think Katie, that's a focus of her dissertation, so we'll learn more when she gets that done. So, if you have a vision of a fully engaged Oregon, an Oregon where our citizens participate in evaluating issues on the merits and facts, independently gathered, as Greg elaborated on, and not on the rhetoric that is currently commonplace, if you want an Oregon of citizens who can be called upon to create new ideas, solve problems, and resolve issues, and who can do this at the state, regional, and local levels, then this can actually build the infrastructure to do just that. It's not just the initiative review process. It has bigger impacts, potential. I know you will think I'm likely overstating this, but I've watched the impact this has had on me. I have a fair amount of professional background that I feel like supports that, and I believe this is exactly what we can achieve through this process. Through this relatively simple citizens' initiative review process, you will have produced a citizenry whose initiative we can unleash on any issue, and as a result, make Oregon better and healthier and unique among all states. I loved what John was saying in the beginning about our innovation. So those are my comments. I thank you for the time. It's been a pleasure to come down here on several occasions and be part of this process. So thank you.
Thank you both for your comments. I wanted to ask you, were you compensated for your time that you spent, and did either of you have trouble getting 5 days is a pretty big commitment to make out of your lives. Did you have any problem being able to devote this much time to this process?
I didn't have any problem. I unfortunately tend to lose vacation time, so this allowed me to take a week's worth, and that was actually beneficial to do that. There was a daily rate that we did receive, and travel expenses and things like that, which was really important because there were some people on our committee who were unemployed. There were people who had children that they had to arrange, and there was actually provisions there if they had brought their children that they would have provided for that. So they really worked to try and eliminate barriers that might have prevented people's participation. So.
Yeah, we received $750 for our time. Mileage from our home, I think it was about 45 cents then. I think it's 50 cents right now to travel. The money that's spent in this thing, when I first heard the figure they used for the two people in 2010, I'm old guy, still thinking of the 1900s. But in 2010, I thought at first, man, that's a lot of money. But then when I really looked at the process and looked at what I believe is a bang for the buck that Oregon's getting, I don't think you'll find a better bang for your dollar for what these 24 people are able to give for you to read as voters and for your constituents to read and everybody else. It's awesome. Can I make a comment? It's kind of out of character, but just a little off the change.
Sure.
You know, the man was up here earlier, he was talking about in the voter's pamphlet, put an R or REP or DEC. R, a lot of times in parentheses, stands for representative, not just Republican. So just if you just think about that and then your deliberation, a lot of times I look at that and I go like, well, is this guy a Republican or is he a representative? Who is he? You know, so that was just my thought on that.
And just to add a quick piece on that, one of the wonderful things about the Citizens Initiative Review is that it has been funded through grants and foundations and that kind of thing. So it hasn't cost, nor is it intended to really cost Oregon any money in that process. So, and it's going to contribute a lot to the knowledge that's out there. So.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, great. Thank you both your time that you spent on this project and for telling us about it.
Thank you. Then
I think we wanted to conclude with some closing comments from Mr. Shuford. If you'd like to come back up.
Do I need to introduce myself again?
Yeah, and please do reintroduce yourself for the record.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elliot Shuford. I'm from Portland, Oregon, co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. We wanted to wrap up with just a couple of slides discussing our current legislation, but to recap today's presentation, we feel by all measures that the reviews were a success. The results of those reviews went into a prominent new place in the voters' pamphlet for the first time. That evaluation showed that was very useful for voters. And it was a quality deliberation. One of the things that we did to promote the Citizens Initiative Review is Tyrone and I got in our cars and drove around the state and met with editorial boards and editors and newspaper reporters, and it was very well received. So here's a few comments that came back from various editors around the state. And in particular, the East Oregonian quote I think is a nice transition to our current legislation, and they wrote, "This is a great idea that deserves enactment and eventual extension into the biennial election process." So that's what we're working on now. The 2009 legislation, House Bill 2895, has sunset, and we want to continue to provide this voters access with this high-quality and trustworthy information. So in our current legislation, House Bill 2634 proposed just that, carrying forward all the provisions that were in that legislation. It also creates an additional level of oversight and accountability to the Citizens Initiative Review. And I should mention here that we have strong bipartisan support. Both the co-speakers are on the bill. We've had great help from several Republican members of the Rules Committee on the House side. And we think that this accomplishes our goals without impeding access to the ballot, which I know is a concern for some members of the legislature. In just a quick comparison here, this gives you a visual comparison of the 2009 legislation and our current legislation. Again, it extends the no fiscal impact, the select and the random, but demographically balanced panelists, and then the placement in the voters pamphlet, as well as several other provisions that provide structure and integrity to the Citizens Initiative Review process. House Bill 2634 adds an independent commission to provide oversight. It also creates an independent fund called the Citizens Initiative Review Fund, and it has provisions there for an ongoing evaluation as part of the process to, if there were any problems to arise, it would address those publicly and bring those to light and create a corrective mechanism.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So the commission, who gets... What's the appointment process for the commission?
So Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, the appointment process are gubernatorial appointments based on recommendations from Senate leaders of both parties. And that is for the fifth members of the explanatory statement committees. There's three parts to the commission. Former fifth members of explanatory statement committees, the ones that are appointed by the members, the opposing members of the explanatory statement mm-hmm. process, so those that are seen as a fair third side or a fair arbiter of that process. And then former moderators and former panelists from the process as well. So those are members that have expertise in the Citizens Initiative Review process and can oversee and make sure that there's integrity to it.
How's it staffed?
There's no provisions in the bill except that there's an option to create or to hire a executive director. That's a permissive part of the bill. And the option is for them to enter into contracts or to hire executive director and staff. Our goal right now is to make sure that this is funded through the Citizens Initiative Review Fund, through foundation grants, and I'll just close with this, but foundation grants, individual contributions, and staffing could be built up that way, or it could, they could work with an independent nonprofit to do the staffing. And as we expected, we expect that House Bill 2634 will have no fiscal impact. So we will be going to Ways and Means to work our way through that process for the expenditure limitation. But beyond that, we don't expect there to be a significant or any fiscal impact. And we're happy to answer any questions at this time.
And so is the proposal to continue as a project that would just select a couple of measures out of each election, or is it to do all of them?
It is up to the commission as to how many or which measures to review. And so the proposal would be that any that have substantial fiscal impact or constitutional amendment, or if the commission deems that it's an important one to review, they'd be able to review those. The bill lays out criteria for that selection, which are the fiscal fiscal impact, constitutionality, and available funds.
Cool. And did you, so because you only did two of the measures in this last cycle, did you have any experience of people wondering where were the comparable statements on all those other measures that were in their voters' pamphlets?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, that's something anecdotally we heard, but it isn't necessarily something that that I'm aware of that was looked at in Professor Gass or Dr. Gastel's evaluation. So, we heard that every now and again. It was, we expected to see it for all of them, but we didn't. Mm-hmm. But you know, I only heard that maybe perhaps one or two times. I don't know.
He's shaking his head, so I don't think he went into that as part of the evaluation. Okay. So I don't have any other questions, and I don't see any other questioners. So thank you.
Thank you very much
for the presentation. Very instructive. Okay, and I think that completes the presentations for today. So I will close the informational hearing. And with nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned.